The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy, managing partner of the Oakmont Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, managing partner of the Oakmont Group. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now, your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been on the air now for 11 years here on Federal News Radio, about 525 shows. I guess it's time for some kind of a retrospective or a overall view of what's happening and what's to come. So instead of dedicating an entire one-hour show to my rambling on, what I decided to have a creative show where I'd split it up. The first half of the show will be an interview with a gentleman by the name of Will Hurd. He is the chairman of the Information Technology Subcommittee on Oversight and Government Reform. He has come up with some pretty good ideas on helping the federal government with the area of information technology. Second half of the show is going to be me rambling on about insights I've learned over the years here about general trends in technology and maybe a look at the future of information technology and the federal government. I guess this is really a balanced show. The first half is about a bright young lawmaker trying to make life easier for my govies. The second half is the soporific meanderings of a tortured soul who is no stranger to the birthday cake. In other words, me. I'll make a transition here, and we'll open up here with the interview with Will Hurd, and I'll come back and take a break. Last week I was at an event, and I heard the representative speak, and I said, boy, this guy's great. We got to get him on the air. We got to talk to him, you know. My audience here on Federal News Radio is federal information technology professionals. And in that room, there was about 100 of them, but I thought, let's take your message and take it to a wider audience. All those people in DOD that can't make it to the meetings up on Capitol Hill, that can't make it to the museum, and that's why I have you in here. Before we begin, maybe a quick thumbshell background, please.
Sure. I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and got a degree in computer science from Texas A&M University. And my freshman year, I had never been outside of Texas, and I'm walking across campus and I see a sign that says take two journalism classes in Mexico City for $425, and I had $450 in my bank account. So I went to Mexico, fell in love being in on the culture, added international studies as a minor, had a former CIA officer as a professor, and that began my interest in the CIA. And so when I graduated, I went into the clandestine service. So I was the dude in the back alleys at 4 o'clock in the morning collecting intelligence on threats to our homeland. So it was best job, 2 years in D.C., 2 years in India, 2 years Pakistan, 2 years New York City, year and a half in Afghanistan, where I managed all of our undercover operations. And I also had to brief members of Congress, and I was pretty shocked by the caliber of our elected leaders. And so I decided to run for Congress.
The most interesting man in Congress, you know. I think you had a candidate, you're a good candidate for that, aren't you?
Right. It was a great experience. And when I ran the first time, I lost, but that gave me an opportunity to go in the private sector, and I helped start a cybersecurity company. So we did technical vulnerability assessment, penetration testing, things like that. And it was great to learn the threats that the private sector is faced, but also to understand the talent that we have in the private sector as well. So that agency experience, the private sector experience, has been great to use it on things like IT procurement here since I've been in Congress for the last 2.5 years.
A typical listener for my show, they show up for work at 9 o'clock in the morning, and by 9:15, they're calling suicide hotline. They have no budget. They got to, in the morning, they have to lock everything down. In the afternoon, they got to open everything up. And so some of the ideas you brought up last week, I think, apply directly to my audience. And I'm going to start off with a quote that I really loved. They never held a parade for federal procurement, did they?
They haven't, but the way we purchase IT goods and services is important. And we all know the stats. $90 billion is spent a year on purchasing IT goods and services throughout the government, and 70% of that is on legacy systems, and that's absolutely outrageous. And one of the problems that we have is our federal CIOs haven't always been given the authority to be involved in the purchasing decisions of whatever widget they want to put onto the network. And so when the person buying the IT goods and service is not necessarily the person using the IT goods and service, you have a disconnect. And so that's why laws like FRTARA are important in order to make sure federal CIOs have all the responsibilities for, you know, when it comes to that network. And that's something that we do a scorecard on. I chair the Information Technology Subcommittee within Oversight and Government Reform, and we do we call it the FITARA scorecard now, but we're going to be moving to a digital hygiene scorecard. And one of the things that we found was, as we try to give the CIOs more authority legislatively, that they were coming into problems with CFOs, with agency heads, and there's still a lot of CIOs that don't report directly to the agency head or the deputy agency head. That's outrageous. This is a C-suite function. This is an executive function, and this is something where you should have CIOs reporting directly to the front office, if you will.
You've dealt with a lot of software developers. I have too. They can't talk without a whiteboard. And if we put this structure on the whiteboard, you'd see the CIO maybe not reporting to the head of the agency. And this it wouldn't work in any small company.
It wouldn't work in any small company. This is something that the private sector has already moved to. They realize that IT and cybersecurity is not just a cost center, that it's important to the everyday operations of their business. And so that's what we're trying to make sure we're focused on. So when we bring in, when we do oversight in Congress on defending digital infrastructure, that's why we bring in the CIO, we're going to bring in the CFO, and we're going to bring in the deputy agency head, because they all three are responsible. And I don't want to hear any more excuses, because a lot of times it's not excuses by the CIO. The CIO says, I want to do this, but I don't have the authority. And it's like, why don't you have the authority? It's because the CFO is preventing that from happening. Okay, well, let's have the CFO come in and enjoy the oversight hearings in Congress on Capitol Hill as well. And that's how Congress can continue to do oversight. But also, this is why, one of our key signature pieces of legislation is the MGT Act, the Modernizing Government Technology Act. It's real simple. If a federal CIO saves money by modernizing his or her digital infrastructure, the money they save, they can put in a working capital fund and have access to it for 3 years. Now you have a motivation to save money. I think people don't realize how large our federal systems are, and that if you try to modernize, you can't make changes and use savings all within the same calendar year. So making sure that our federal CIOs are not penalized for becoming leaner, meaner, and more efficient, but that they have the ability to use that. And so this bill has passed the House, it passed the Senate on the NDAA, and now we're in conference between the House and the Senate on the NDAA, and MGT will stay on that. So hopefully by middle of December, this becomes law, and our federal CIOs will have another tool in their toolkit in order to do the difficult task of defending federal infrastructure.
And I want to say that many of the people who work for the federal government, they're really smart folks. There's a gentleman over at DOD, his name is Leo Garcia. He's well known in the DevOps community. He's well known in the commercial DevOps community too. Really bright young people. And why put handcuffs on them? I mean, I think some things you are doing are freeing people like Leo Garcia to do his job.
Absolutely. It's a difficult task, right? And because of the size of many of our networks and our infrastructure, it's difficult to defend. And you also have a shortage of people. GAO believes that there's about 10,000 positions across the federal IT space that has gone unfilled. We also have a difficulty in chasing talent, and we're never going to be able to compete with the private sector, and the private sector has a dearth of people as well. And so that's why one of the next pieces of legislation I'm working on is, I call it the Cyber National Guard. If a kid in high school wants to go to college and needs money and they want to study something around cybersecurity, we're going to find some scholarships for them. But then if they take scholarship money, they have to come work in the federal government for the same amount of time. So if you get a 4-year scholarship to go to Texas A&M University, you're going to come work in the federal government for 4 years, but not at NSA or DOD, but you're going to come work at the U.S. Census Bureau, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Interior, places like that. And after you'd spend that time there and you want to go work in the private sector, that private sector company is going to loan you back into the federal government for 10 days every other quarter. All right. So this is going to allow for a cross-pollinization of ideas. If you're a CIO and you know you have a talented person and you're going to have a pipeline of talent for a certain period of time today, you can develop projects for someone with that talent to work on. So this is the next piece of legislation that we're going to try to work on, and again, to make sure we address the hiring issues.
It's almost like a farm club. And you don't pop in some of the major leagues. What you do is maybe give them a few years, a taste of the majors, develop up a wide range of people. It's a real nice way to bring along youngsters.
It is, because the reality is, because our systems are so big, it's a type of experience that you can't get anywhere else. And learning how to defend and make large networks operate is a skill set that you can only get in a very few places. So we are developing a talent pool that can be helpful and to develop the latest and greatest tools and techniques that can be reintroduced into the federal government.
I've been doing the show for 11 years, and a few years back, I had a guy named Vivek Kundra in the studio, and he was pounding the table talking about moving to the cloud and reducing the number of data centers. And that's all great and good, except it's 7 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, have they been hiding, or where they been hiding for 7 years?
This is one of those things that I just don't understand. I don't understand how there's too many people that talk about the cloud as if it's new technology. The cloud is not emerging technology. It has emerged, and we should be transitioning to it. It can be secured, right? It's just like any other tool. And when you deal with large amounts of data, being able to have it in the cloud, it, you know, creates some efficiencies that's valuable. And it's mind-blowing to me that we still have thousands of data centers that we haven't been able to transition. And, you know, again, part of it is because of the shackles that many of our CIOs have on their hands, because of their inability to purchase the things and the tools that they need. And so we're hopefully working on that and fixing that problem.
I got up early this morning, went to YouTube, I typed in your name, and I saw a C-SPAN interview. That was really a good one. I thought it was a great interview you had. You talked about so many different topics, and the topics you talk about, they're nonpartisan. I mean, a Democrat, Republican can both get attacked by ransomware. I mean, this is equal.
It is. It's cybersecurity, IT procurement is a truly bipartisan issue, and my partner in this endeavor is Robin Kelly from the great state of Illinois. She is thoughtful, she is smart, and she has, working with her on all of these issues, is, I think, set the tone for many of our other colleagues. Then you have the leaders of both parties. Kevin McCarthy, he's a technologist. His innovation initiative is something that has been driving some good legislation through last Congress. And Steny Hoyer as well, the leader on the Democratic side from Maryland, is someone who is committed to this. And he was one of the original co-sponsors of the MGT Act as well.
Interesting. You know, we moved 2 years ago. We downsized, and I was surprised how much junk we had when we moved to a smaller house. One problem that I think many federal agencies have is they don't know what they have in their house, in their data center. And they don't even, first of all, they don't know how many data centers they have. And okay, you have 100 data centers. Now, what is in there? What's the survey? You can't eliminate duplicate costs unless you know where the duplicate costs are.
So we do this Vitara scorecard twice a year. It is mind-boggling to me that every time we do it, some agency finds out that they have more data centers.
And, oh, surprise. Yeah, you have a third garage.
Right. Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. And it's like there's software out there that tells you what's all on your network. And so these are some of the basic things that we have to fix, and why that we all know that they are the standards when it comes to good digital system hygiene, and why we're not using it, I don't know. And look, I represent 29 counties, 820 miles of the border, two time zones. It takes 10 and a half hours to drive across my district, and it's from San Antonio to El Paso. San Antonio, the seventh largest city in the United States of America. It is the second largest concentration of cybersecurity professionals in the country, and the first being, of course, the Washington, you know, National Capital Region. And then I have El Paso on the other end, right? Big Fort Bliss, a growing city, and more cows than people in between, right? I think I represent more cows in Congress than any other member of Congress.
Put that on the t-shirt, huh?
Yeah. But when you tell people, when you go out to West Texas, a town like Fort Stockton, population 2,000, and they want to know what's up with all these attacks. And when you tell them, it was things that could have been prevented by basic things like patching your software, right? By making sure your router doesn't have the password in it, right? You know, these basic things are still happening. And yes, I look at a breach differently if it was a zero-day exploit and it was done by a nation state. That's something that's incredibly hard to defend against. But when your systems are being attacked via known vulnerabilities, it's just unacceptable.
And we talked about bipartisan, Republican, Democrat. You know, these attackers are bipartisan. They do commercial and federal as well. Look at Equifax. I mean, there are some federal information technology professionals out there that are doing their jobs and some commercial folks out. And so I think a lot of my listeners say, well, geez, if I was in the commercial world, this wouldn't happen. No. This happens everywhere. We need someone like you to jump in who has a bachelor's degree in computer science, who's not going to be baffled by information.
Absolutely. Look, I always tell people, if you need help with your Fortran 77 code, I can help on that. But it is good having a technical background and not being afraid of some of these issues. But there's a lot of philosophical questions that have to be answered. And Equifax is a good example. Nobody opted in to sharing their information with Equifax. And so how do those three credit monitoring agencies have access to my information? And whose information is it? Is it my information? And I think the answer is yes. And so how did we get to this situation? And what's scary to me about Equifax is that this has shaken the way we do authentication. You know, in so many applications, to determine who, if you are who you say you are, you use information from your credit report. And now we're not going to be able to do that in the future, and we're going to have to change how we do authentication.
And it changes so quickly. Years ago, they used to send antivirus updates in the mail on the floppy drives.
Yeah, exactly.
I tell my kids that, and they think I went to school with Ben Franklin. What's going on?
Right,
you out of your
right.
mind? What is a floppy disk getting? Your kids are going to be like, not even anything you say.
Right.
So it changes so quickly. I think we have to change the way we procure information technology and handle the talented people in the government now.
You're 100% right. And look, the technological change we're going to see in the next 20 years is going to make the last 20 years look insignificant. And I remembered my first, in seventh grade, I wrote my first report on an actual typewriter. I didn't have a cell phone until I was a junior in college, and that was back when you had regional plans. What we're going to see is going to be pretty amazing, and that's why we have to change the way we legislate as well. We have to legislate and create standards for outcomes and not talking about any particular type of technology. And I think when you look in the financial services industry, the whole chip and PIN. You know, chip and PIN was legislated and mandated, but chip and PIN is kind of already old technology right now, and we've just kind of achieved implementation. Biometrics, and there's so many other things that could be used now, but because of outdated legislation and forcing a particular technology, and this is something that Washington, D.C. isn't prepared for. I think NIST is an entity that is well respected by both industry and the public sector. And how do we ensure that some of the NIST standards and NIST framework grows and evolves with increasing technology? Because the day that quantum computing gets here, and quantum computing is a real thing. It's going to be upon us sooner than later. And you don't have to understand the physics behind quantum computing, that a bit can be a one and zero, both neither or all at the same time. You just have to know that it's going to make encryption, the way we do it now, irrelevant. And we have to prepare for that. There's a reason that the Russian government and the Chinese government are sucking in ciphertext and holding on to that, because they're going to be able to decrypt it once they achieve quantum. And we need to be thinking about quantum computing the way we did Y2K. No, I remember when I was in college when Y2K was upon us, and I literally had a debate: was I going to hang out with my buddies that night, or like stay close to home because I didn't know what was going to happen the next day? And then nothing happened because we were prepared for it. We took time, we took money, we took energy in dealing with Y2K, and I think we need to do the same thing around quantum. And many folks that talk about this issue call it Y2Q, years to quantum, and we need to be prepared for that.
You know, on December 27th, 1999, I was on television with Ted Koppel, and I had to predict. I particularly be fine. I remember those years well. Quantum, of course, has been around since before 1999, 1985. Finally, it's like having a Ferrari in a garage. Finally, the roads can handle it. Finally, we have enough compute power for it and storage that we can actually use it as a tool. So we're getting real close.
We're getting exceptionally close. And one of the things I've always learned from my 9.5 years being in the CIA, you know, you always have these intelligence assessments. I think the intelligence assessments about how long it's going to take for something to happen, I would always take those assessments and divide it by half. And that usually is what we see. So it's going to be upon us sooner rather than later. Whoever masters this first is really going to be the hegemon.
Representative Hull, we have about 30 seconds left. You want to punch through anything?
Well, do I want to punch through
anything? I want to punch through MDA.
I want to punch through how the federal government buys goods and services. You know, I think it's crazy that, like, little things. Like, you can't talk to the vendor when the contract is submitted. No, that's the time when you should be refining the contract and making sure that they understand what the RFP is. And if we change the way the government operates, then we can change outcomes.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We're in the offices of Representative Will Hurd up on Capitol Hill. Welcome back to Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is John Gilroy, and this is Federal Tech Talk. We are doing an unusual show today. After 11 years on the air, I want to do a kind of a retrospective here. Thought it might be a good idea to combine it with an interview with Will Hurd. The first part of the show was an interview with Will, the representative from Texas, who has some good ideas on improving the federal government. I hope you've all listened to that carefully. Second half of the show is maybe a summary of what I've learned and some themes I've seen over the last 11 years. I thought it might be a good way to start off here. When I first started the show in, I think it was 2006, I wanted to bring in a wide range of guests with a variety of ideas on how to make life for my listeners easier. So the first guest was the universal company I knew at the time called Microsoft. They're in everywhere, word processors and spreadsheets. So my first guest was Kim Nelson from Microsoft. And from there, I branched off into just about every company I can think of. We also had the founder of Wikipedia, a guy named Jimmy Wales. And we had the dapper father of the internet, Vint Cerf. So we had a whole wide range of guests here in the last 11 years. Now, let's turn our attentions to the federal audience. Generally speaking, federal folks are a lot harder to schedule than commercial folks. Normally, I'd have to go through some kind of a screening from the public affairs office, and they want to vet the show, see what it's all about. So it's hard to get guests from the federal government here, but somehow I managed to get people from a few different agencies. For example, we've had guests here from the Air Force, from the Army, from the Department of Energy, from Labor, from Education, State Department, Treasury, Energy, Justice, and some acronyms here, DISA, the DOD, EPA, Federal Aviation Administration, the GAO, GSA, Health and Human Services. Boy, that's a big group there. IRS, NASA, NIST. Those smart people up at NIST even came down here. NRC, the NSA. Woo, that was a scary interview. ONIC, USDA, the Small Business Administration, SBA. I think one of the best guests was the interview you just heard, was Will Hurd from up on the Hill. He was a very interesting character. Now, the reason I selected Will was threefold. Number one, he's got a bachelor's degree in computer science. You know and I know that there are committee members on the Hill that, let's say, are dated. Let's say they're consumer tested. And they get up there and they kind of ask questions of people. And it may happen that there are certain individuals that may use some language that try to dazzle them. And you know what? It's not going to happen with Will Hurd. I mean, he is very sharp. He's up to date with what technology is all about. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to dazzle him with acronyms that he doesn't know anything about. Secondly, believe it or not, Will speaks Urdu and Spanish. You know, it doesn't take a PhD to look around the government corridors and see the landscape is changing. We need someone who at least has a passing knowledge of some of the cultural challenges for working for the federal government. And by the way, the cultural challenges in South Texas involve rural communities, urban communities, a lot of Spanish speakers, all kinds of different people in South Texas. So it's a very interesting part of the world to be from. Finally, you know, this why Will is a humble guy. If you listen to the interview, I told him that I watched his C-SPAN interview, and he told me that I should find a better hobby. So finally, we have a guy who's very humble. We need someone here, you know, who is humble and a little different from the typical high-level person. His admonition for me to find a better hobby is a refreshing change from the standard operating procedure at the upper levels of the federal government. Well, after 525 interviews, I see several themes. One is the feeling of inadequacy in the federal IT professional. Two, this confusion with technology because it's changing so fast. And three, there's this noble but futile attempt to keep up with the rapid changes in technology. And is it futile or not? I don't know. It's the same kind of problem that most people have. Let's maybe expand on each one of these concepts, and I'll give you what my perspective is after these 525 interviews. You know, I go to a lot of events. Many times I'm the only non-govy in the audience. So we get a chance to speak to a lot of federal IT folks in a casual environment, and they may be more open than they are in a more structured environment like the radio studio here. One theme is that for some reason, commercial IT community, here's what they say. Well, you know, the commercial IT community is way ahead of us, and those commercial folks are the bright, shining star that a mere govy could only hope to emulate. Well, let me respond to that with one word. And the one word is Equifax. It seems to me that they are a commercial organization that blew it. Not only did they blow it, but many of them ties into the federal government as well. It could affect you, my listeners. You know, the personal information on 143 million people released 6 weeks after it happened, I have some questions there about the what went on there. Also, there's some murky information exactly how the attack was done, and does the company have future adequate defenses, you know? There's some kind of questions here, especially if you read some of the news sources here. What happened with that stock transaction before the announcement was made? And what about this golden parachute that the leader has? You know, I think this is a whole lot of stuff. I don't think you should look to the commercial world for their guidance because they're screwing up just as much as everyone else. You know, Equifax is a critical partner with the federal government. They're tied into the IRS, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Has there been irreparable harm done? Is there need for new regulation? Well, maybe the govies should step in here and start regulating more carefully some of the best practices that we seem to see in the commercial world, and maybe they're not as sharp as you may think they are. You know, people talk about managing and detecting software, and this is what the problem with Equifax was, you know. They didn't know that there was a vulnerability. I think the vulnerability was apparent in March, and 3 days later, they got hit. But they didn't repair the patch on the system that they had. And so this whole idea of dependencies, unintended consequences, and threats, you know, this was a failure to do something basic. This wasn't a sophisticated attack. This was a basic, simple attack, but they didn't have patches in their system. This is what caused it. So, you know, you get to wonder that, you know, how smart are these people in the commercial world? And should my listeners actually be looking at them, or should they be looking somewhere else as far as ideals, as far as managing and patching their systems? There's a concept out there called the ROI, return on investment. And I love talking about ROI, I love talking about money. And frequently in the show, I talk about this 1936 song from Woody Guthrie. He wrote a song called It's All About the Do-Re-Mi. And the do he's talking about is the money. He's talking about migrations, but I apply this to the federal government here. So let's move to the cloud, move to the cloud, move to the cloud. Well, you know, this has been going on for many, many years here. I've had Vivek Kundra in the studio many years ago, pounding at the table with 25-point plan, go to the cloud, go to the cloud, go to the cloud. What we have now is we have many agencies are looking at the cloud and wondering if they really are saving any money at all, you know? Now, from a commercial perspective, let's take a look at the commercial perspective, you know? David Linthicum has written 13 books on IT. We've had him in the studio before. His most recent article, InfoWorld, talked about, well, what is the ROI from the cloud? And are there organizations that are moving back from the cloud? They're looking at the cloud and saying, no, there's really not enough here for us to say to justify this expense, you know? So I think what you have to do is you have to look at them and go, well, you know, what really is the ROI from my agency on this? Is it a value? What happens is sometimes you may budget certain expenses for cloud services and wind up spending them all in the first 2 or 3 months. And this is a very, very difficult problem for many of my agencies, and we've talked about this several times in the show. You know, there are some vendors out there who realize that there's weaknesses in their systems, but what they'd rather do is hide than fix these vulnerabilities. You know, I mean, it gets to the problem where, well, you trust a vendor, and they can have their bottom line impacted by doing remediation of the problems they have in the system, but rather than doing that, what they do is they just hide it and obfuscate it and cloud it over, and hide rather than fix is kind of a problem I've seen over the years as well. You know, there's the one balance here is what's good and what's good enough. There's no agency who's listening to this who has unlimited funds. What role can a federal agency have in making recommendations as to proper allocation of funds to accomplish security requirements in an efficient manner? How much money do you spend? You know, how much money do you spend on security? And what is the balance there between security and, you know, not running out of money?
Let's take a break and come back. We'll talk more about my observations over the last 11 years, some themes I've seen, and talk more about my predictions for the future. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In a recent Gartner symposium, there's a guy named Earl Perkins who said, you can't protect everything. And if that's the case, what can you protect? It goes back to what we were previously talking about, return on investment and balancing and what's good and what's good enough. And this is the dilemma all my listeners are facing here. You know, I mean, how much of a limited budget can they throw at computer security? You know, talks about return on investment. And inevitably, it becomes down to who do you blame? Okay, well, this person was not effective. This person was effective. You know, misconfigured software and services are leading to accidental exposure of much data. Dependencies, unintended consequences, insider threat. We see this repeating time and time and time again. What can happen is that people just don't spend enough time on some of the basic blocking and tackling, or they assume that the commercial organization that they're involved with do that as well. I don't know if that's a fair assumption anymore. A lot of topics over the years that I've been involved with here brought these people in. But there's one topic that most people don't talk about at all. It's called the dark web. It's just something you don't want to talk about at all. I don't know why. There's a local company here in Northern Virginia. It's called SurfWatch. I had a conversation with a guy named Chip Hathaway. And he talks about interesting about Equifax and says, well, you know, let's look at Equifax. There are people on the dark web who claim to have information on the Equifax breach, and they have some information there. And he talks about recovering it. I think there has to be more information and more shows done by my half on this whole dark web. What's this got to do with the federal government? What is the dark web? What does it mean? Are there people exchanging information on the dark web who shouldn't know about? And if they are, I mean, you know, how is that going to impact your agency and who should you trust as far as getting information about the dark web? You know, the idea of training is close to my heart. I think my regulars know that I teach over here at Georgetown and I'm in the classroom all the time. And, you know, I think it's really important in the area of cybersecurity to get trained and get up to speed. And this isn't necessarily going to the library and checking out a book. You must have current training because things are changing all the time. The National Cybersecurity Institute has a great quote here. That every employee at every level plays a role in the cybersecurity of an organization. What I've seen is some people in the Air Force, they have their families who are being attacked. In other words, if you're at an organization that is secure and your spouse may have an email address, what some people may do is use that email address of your spouse and use it as a phishing attack to go after you. So if you're not trained in exactly what to do, what not to do, this can be a very, very dangerous situation. You know, I think one of the big takeaways over the last few years is that the users should have cybersecurity training and awareness program and a thorough understanding of the role that they all play. Where does the training start? Is it just 9 to 5 Monday through Friday? Is it the extended family? Is it 24 hours, 7 days a week? You know, I think you have to change your whole way you think about training. And I think one way is with something called gamification. I'm going to do a show here in about a week. And it's with a company called One Huddle. And they have a new approach to training. What they say is that the traditional approach where once a year you sit in a room and have some person in the front of the room with a bunch of PowerPoint slides, that type of training is horse and buggy training in today's day. What you have to do is do something different. And that's why I brought in One Huddle. What they do is they gamify on phones. And so they can offer training that allows people to use their own phones at their time to take and learn about critical ideas involved with cybersecurity and many different aspects of training. And now, I don't know if One Huddle's got the answer, but I know one thing. PowerPoint is really, really good at putting people to sleep. In order to train people today, you have to come up with the creative, original ways. Maybe it's short videos. Maybe it's some kind of gamification. Maybe it's a combination of face-to-face training and gamification and certain qualifications. Maybe there's some kind of an inducement where you get certification at one level. But, you know, the way that people have been trained in the last 15 or 20 years is going to have to change because human beings have changed the way they consume information now. If you go to YouTube, you know, if you don't catch someone's attention within 8 seconds of a video there, you've lost them completely, you know. Typically, there's all kinds of new ways that people train now, and believe me, in the classroom, I've been the first one to be blamed, you know. I'm sitting in the classroom with a 2.5-hour class, and I go through my PowerPoint slides. I can watch people just fall off and fall right to sleep. So in the last couple of years, I've changed the way I've gotten students much more involved. In fact, to get my students out in the community And believe it or not, I think that's a whole better way to learn. Let's talk about drones. Another big topic that I see, you know, it's kind of surprised me in the last 5 or 6 years. You know, who doesn't love drones? You know, in Loudoun County, there's a drone racing league. You know, I think there's a lot of issues involved with drones that directly affect my listeners. For example, privacy issues. You know, who is going to control the privacy of someone with a drone with a camera? Is it the federal government? Is it the local government? I don't know. Now, some estimate that there's going to be over 20,000 unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, in the United States in the next couple of years. Who's going to regulate them? Even more, who's going to train them? This is fascinating. We had Avery Brown on the air from a company called DAM, D-A-M, Drone Airspace Management. He says their big challenge is taking and just training enough people to handle this big flood of drones that are coming to market here. And so where are the drones headed? Who's going to train them? You know, it's incredible. And just think of it. Okay, so what does a drone do? A drone goes out there, may have a camera, and might soak in a lot of information. So it's bringing a lot of information in a data center. That's one challenge with managing that data. Who has the policies for that? The other challenge that I see coming out is also an aircraft. Let's say if you're on a commercial airline and you want to have a Wi-Fi access. It's quite possible that you get your Wi-Fi out, get Netflix, and want to see a movie. That information is going the other way. So you have information from a data center going out to a wireless capability, and the drone is the opposite of the drone soaking up all kinds of information, bringing it back to a data center. So both different ways, and both have to be managed by the federal government. Okay, who manages the data? Who secures it? What role should the federal government play? Should it have any role at all? How does it organizes signals that go to these planes for Wi-Fi access? What about satellites? How do they fit into all this? It gets so confusing. Over the last 11 years, I've noticed something kind of crawl up to. It's called the Internet of Things, the IoT. What fascinates me about this is not the IoT, but it's the IoT, Internet of Toys. An article I saw in the Washington Post about 2 weeks ago. The FBI has a whole list of 15 threats that are involved in the Internet of Toys. Now, I read this article. I was mildly entertained. My kids are grown, and I don't have to worry about buying toys for my kids. However, you know, is this a real good use of the time for the FBI? It would seem to me that they may have bigger fish to fry than worrying about the software that can access information on children. Now, you know, I probably have a different opinion if my kids were 2 and 3 years old and had 15 or 20 devices surrounding them in their home that could record their conversations, maybe even have a video feedback to some bad person somewhere. I don't know. When it comes to IoT, I think the place to get worried about IoT is with medical devices. And we've seen hospitals be subjected to ransomware. It all ties in ransomware, data centers, security, best practices, cyber training. At what point in time do you feel secure at all? You know, when I think of medical devices, IoT, I go back to the satellites. You know, that's another hot topic that I never thought would be popular here in the federal community. You know, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, constellations of small satellites, you know, people in Texas successfully having launches. I mean, it's just the whole idea is crazy. When I'm at conferences, I talk to people, and one really popular subject now is geospatial information. You know, geospatial classes are being offered in high schools here in the Washington, D.C. area. This means so much for back to unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, satellites, observation, geospatial data, information, and autonomous cars. What about autonomous cars? How does it all fit together? Where does the federal government fit in with this whole new world of information technology? All kinds of studies are done for my listeners, federal IT professionals. The Government Business Council did a study, and they showed that 41% of senior employees at major agencies are very or somewhat dissatisfied with their agency's tools and systems. Oh, tools and systems, maybe tools and systems that are used for patching their existing network. So you have to be very careful about, you know, the tools that you use and patching. And if you're dissatisfied with it, you want to buy more or buy different ones, you may not have the budget for it. So your hands may be tied because of budget constraints. You go up the channel to your CIO, there's missing CIO. So this is a dangerous environment to be in right here. There's a concept that I've seen in the last few years come in called, you know, open data. And so what it seems like,
And this was just a mess, basically, to me. So up till noon, you have to take and lock down every kind of system, every cloud app, and look at encryption and what's going on in your system. But afternoon, then you have to and open everything up to open data. So you have to have open data. You have to have open data for people across the United States to pull information out of. But it has to be in a secure environment. Pushed and pulled from two different worlds. It's almost like a paradox, you know? It's like the best of times, it's the worst of times, you know? He's a skinny fat guy or a tall short guy or something that's very difficult to accomplish, you know? On the one hand, you got no budget and you got to lock everything down, be worried about cybersecurity. On the other hand, you got to open everything up. You got to make sure open data is available to citizens. It's kind of difficult. I think that's why many of my listeners don't have a lot of confidence in themselves. And again, back to the start of the show, we talked about, you know, people in the federal government looking at commercial world, but wait a minute, Equifax is in the commercial world and they really screwed up and it can impact my listeners, the federal IT professionals. It's something. Now, I'm going to do an interview here soon and we're going to talk about DevOps in the federal community. There's a guy named Leo Garcia who's one of the leaders in the DevOps community. He's working for the federal government. He has some insights when it comes to DevOps in the federal community. So, you know, you can do it in the federal government. You just have to be careful and detached. And like in the commercial world, learn from as many different sources as you can. A couple topics before I close out here. One is Clone Wars. You know, I think of machine learning and artificial intelligence. I've done some recent shows on that. And I think the application there is going to be for threat detection, threat modeling, and anomaly detection. And I think what every federal information professional should ask themselves is what role do they play in this area, and how is artificial intelligence going to impact my job at cybersecurity? And I think it, you know, wraps up with cybersecurity. The training wraps up with cybersecurity. You know, airspace management, drones, satellites, so many topics that when I started this show 11 years ago, never even thought of. So people want to know what my prediction is. I always ask people at the end of the interview, okay, crystal ball time, tell me exactly what you think about the next 5 years in the federal government. Well, believe it or not, I'm kind of optimistic. I think people are going to figure it out because there's no choice. You know, attack after attack after attack. People are going to figure out the most effective way to handle something with information technology. Yeah, I love reading history. I love reading quotes from this guy named Winston Churchill. And he once said that Americans will always do the right thing after they tried everything else. I think what's going to happen is the community here is going to get maybe caught once or twice. They're going to see what happened to Equifax and change and go down the wrong road. And finally, they'll end up at the right road after much issues and troubles. So I think what's going to happen is everyone listening to this is going to figure this out. I think there are going to be a few attacks. They're going to embarrass some people. They're going to learn and move on, because I believe in Winston Churchill as much as everything else. The Americans here are going to figure it out after they do everything else. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We've had an unusual show today. The first half of the show was an interview with Will Hurd. Second half of the show was kind of like ramblings on different topics that have come up in the last 11 years here on Federal News Radio. And I wanted to give you a perspective of where I think the show is going to be heading. And to more training with cybersecurity, using maybe artificial intelligence and machine learning to help out people automate some of these mechanical processes that they really can't handle. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, Managing Partner at the Oakmont Group. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Federal Tech Talk.